the Why Hockey periodically weird but always unique podcast, because Paul Maurice, when he was asked about it in a recent press conference, how would you describe your dressing room or something to that effect, was talking about how weird and unique it is in the same breath. So Paul Maurice will probably think this podcast is weird, but I think this podcast is weird. He would also think it's unique, and I think it's unique too.
We're already off to the unique start of round two electric problems.
Round two electric boogaloo.
Yeah.
Do we need to play Electric Avenue? Okay, we can't do that because then we'll get copyrighted to oblivion.
That's fine. Bring it on. I got lawyers.
You do. I have lawyers too. I don't want to involve them in this situation. I don't have lawyers.
What I have is a Warren Zevon album with Lawyers, Guns, and Money on it.
That's a good one. I can turn on I Fought the Law off by The Clash if we have to do that too.
As long as it's not the Green Day version.
No, it would not be the Green Day version. I didn't realize that that was
the
Green Day version.
The NHL owns the rights to that song.
I didn't realize that was the Green Day version because you hear it at Panthers games, right? They play it a lot. And I'm like, wait, that's not the Clash version of it.
Not so much this year. When they upgraded the sound system and stuff, it seems that they also upgraded whatever rights holders that they had a partnership with or had a, you know, were paying to use. Because I don't see George tweet out like so many times, like, it's insert whatever 80s song that we've heard for a billion times again.
Do you know what the other song you used to hear all the time at Panthers games? And by the way, the joke is they're now licensing from ASCAP and BMI, not just one. I couldn't tell you which one they were licensing from. That is a very inside baseball joke, by the way. There are some of you out here who probably listen to the show who have no idea what I'm talking about. But do you know what song that they always played at Panthers games up until very recently? Ludacris's Get Out the Way. You heard that song 10 times a night, and they don't play it anymore.
I'm going to be honest. If they could just do it once a night, I'd still be into it.
I think that song rocks, but they played it 15 times a night, and I'm glad they don't play it anymore. They have upgraded.
I think they should play it like if Brendan Montour gets an interference penalty.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Something like that, you know, like that, like that'd be funny. Yeah, nostalgia obviously works, especially, you know, in a market like Miami. They're definitely keen on marketing nostalgia and that kind of stuff.
You're gonna get some Art Deco graphics on the scoreboard. I do wanted to say that's not where I expected the intro to go, but hey, it works. Perfectly describes unique and weird. Because the ending of the season was very unique and weird, and we're gonna talk about that in different avenues. We've got a lot to get to on this show today.
Yeah, I got a lot to say, but I just want to start off with, man, that last podcast we did is aging really well at the moment. Before the playoffs starts, you know, fans are all calm for the most part again, all feeling good. The team is heading into the postseason on an uptick. Everybody feels rested. And they're going to get more rested as some teams have to play two games before the playoffs start and the Panthers are done. So everything that we were saying, you know, just give them time. They might be a little late, but Paul Maurice is doing the things we talked about for the last couple years that go into managing an 82-game season and trying to time it right into the playoffs. Last year, they timed it right out of necessity. This one, they kind of had to manufacture that urgency at the right time, and it seems like they have.
I want to get to the game that we just watched last night. There are going to be, of course, a couple of recordings to come this week to get set with the playoffs. You're listening to this on Thursday, as we do. We record usually on Wednesdays, and then you'll hear the podcast a day later. As you are listening to this, as it drops, I am probably recording an episode with a wonderful guest who has been on Why Hockey previously, but not for a while. I think you'll all really enjoy that show when it is released, so you get two shows to lead into the playoffs.
If you're listening to this episode before that episode, I'll give you a hint. And I guess try to piece it together if you've already listened to the other one.
Yeah, I guess we can drop it in as we go along.
The hint would be same at or or no, the hit would be non-alcoholic beer. You can kind of, it's circuitous, but it gets there.
You'll figure it out as you'll eventually see this Friday. If not, and you already have listened to it, congratulations. You'll enjoy that show just as well. A couple points I want to mention here before we get to the meat of the discussion today, because there's a lot I want to get to, and I'm not going to get to everything today. Sometimes that happens. Firstly, I want to say congratulations to our friend Colby Guy. I don't know if you read what he wrote before the recent game, Autism Awareness Night. It was a beautiful piece. I, too, am on the autism spectrum. I've probably mentioned it on this show, but I would put it as, it's called nonverbal learning disorder. It is on the autism spectrum, but again, to open with the same theme, you could easily just describe it as, oh, he's weird, but it is technically on the autism spectrum. But Colby's a wonderful human being. His coverage is great. He's become ingratiated on the beat, and he's gone through a lot to get to this point, so I'm really proud of him for writing that. It was beautifully done. The support he's getting from not just the fans, but I think the people who cover the team is just really wonderful. There was a nice note from Elliot Friedman as well. So congratulations to Colby on putting that out there. It's obviously really difficult to do, and he did it so eloquently and beautifully. Again, one of our great friends here, and someone who not just he hoped is covering the Panthers for a long time, but covering hockey for a long time. He absolutely deserves it for as long as he can do it, because media jobs are very hard to come by, and stable media jobs are even harder to come by. Another point I wanted to make, also congratulations to Andrew Berkshire. I know we spent a lot of time on a recent podcast talking about his Zach Hyman takes, and I understand that that ruffled some feathers, didn't it? Rankled the old Twitter sphere. But Game Over, which I was on over 2 years ago, is now independent, and it's going to restart, and I love the people who work there. Andrew does a really good job with that, and so very hard to do independent media as well, so I wanted to say congratulations on getting that back up off the ground. Somebody else who, whether you agree with that Zach Hyman take or not, I have to say I really appreciate what he does, and he covers the Canadiens really well. He's going to be great to talk to when they actually are good, so congratulations to him on getting that set up. Really looking forward to seeing where that goes and being possibly able to work with him again. That was a great pleasure. If you didn't see what I did then, it was the January 1st game of 2022 when the Panthers beat the Canadiens by a trillion and the Habs had like 16 players because of COVID. I was on with Jack Hahn. That was a really, really fun time, and I hope to be able to do that again. On this show today, Matt, you're listening to me speak right now, Tommy, on the other end, why hockey as we get ready for the Stanley Cup playoffs. We're going to start with talking about the Panthers. There's a lot to get to and how the season ended and who they're going to end up playing. Then we're going to talk about the Flyers because, of course, both of us Delaware Valley area natives, the Flyers had a fascinating end of the season. Got to start with the future of that franchise and where they're going to head, because it looked like they were going to make the playoffs and then they didn't. And then we're going to talk about the Arizona Coyotes because we have to. And by the time you listen to this, they may have already announced that they're moving to Utah. We're recording this. It hasn't happened yet, but it will probably. And there's a lot that I want to get to with talking about that move.
By the end of the Friday news dump hour, it will be announced. I can't imagine it.
There's a lot. There's so many different layers to it. And it's not just because we follow the Panthers on this show. And this could have easily been Florida at some point. It's not going to be anymore. But there are layers that I want to get to. Hockey at Arizona, talking about the commissioner and so many other areas that I think are very important when this discussion inevitably is going to keep coming around again, and what this means about the future of the league. And I have some ideas about what it means for the future of the league in so many different areas. Now, you were right about the Panthers again, because on Why Hockey, we're not wrong. We're just early sometimes. And you once again have another prediction where you were early on, because when we recorded the last show, it was in the middle of a stretch where they were 2-7-1 and they really weren't playing very well. They had that loss in Montreal where people started to freak out a little. And I don't blame them. They're fans. Fans are going to act the way they act. I can't tell somebody how to fan. I can't tell somebody else how to cover a team. And then after that, they went 5-0-1 and they stabilized pretty, I won't say dramatically, but they figured it out. A light bulb went off. They played against the Bruins. They dominated the third period of that game. They lost in overtime. But the third period of that game, I think, convinced a good number of people that everything's probably going to be okay. And then the first period of the Toronto game, people were a little nervous. And then in the second period, they played probably the best period of hockey I have seen a team play against another playoff team in a very long time. They took off the 30-shot marker that they had apparently achieved But incredible second period, and then I think everybody's now is like, okay, they're probably going to be all right. And
yeah,
now we can focus on topics other than are they going to be okay? Because I don't think that was a really fun discussion when every one of us, I think, knew whether you're covering the team, whether you're just a fan, that they're probably going to figure it out because they've done it before when they were in not good stretches this season. And they had a bit of an easy layup of a run-in other than Boston and Toronto to figure some things out.
Absolutely. I really thought they, you know, over 82 games, there's going to be lulls, there's going to be points, and we talked about Maurice needing to find the right times to let things go and not press. You know, when they were 2-7-1, they probably could have pulled out of that a little earlier. But, you know, did Maurice want to burn a card yapping at him, you know, getting him going with the stick more than the carrot? I think, you know, he realized he could earn back, he could earn some even more cachet in the locker room by, you know, being patient with them, being, you know, having understanding and belief in the group. And you've seen what it has been able to do.
I mean, I have seen some dominant Panthers periods. That was maybe the most dominant. And they didn't score on the power play, too. And they had some really, really good looks, did they not?
Yeah, I mean, 0-for-4 on the penalty, I mean, on the power play, you know, off the top wasn't very inspiring. But if you're looking at it beyond the numbers, they were doing well. You'd expect one or two of those shots to go in most nights. And that's kind of just how it's been the last couple of games. When things aren't going well, there's something where you can easily point to and be like, yeah, I don't see how this is going to continue in the playoffs. Like, you know, this won't be the case. And that's something that we've been lucky enough to experience with the Panthers this year. And, you know, I know there's probably still some hand-wringing about, especially after seeing Wall in net last night, like, couldn't they figure out a way to lose while playing good instead of, you know, coming out a little flatter in the first period and finding a way to win? Because Vasilevsky, Kucherov, Stamkos, Point in the playoffs doesn't seem like a reward for winning the division compared to a team that hardly ever wins the first round, and a team where either Carter Verhaeghe's child is the one goalie or Joseph Wall, who can easily be batted around by our offense. So, you know, I think Toronto was the easier matchup, but I love the mentality that this Florida Panthers have. Not only are they gritty and competitive, but they want to win. Like, it was clear the way they came out in the second period, they said that they would rather win the division and play Tampa than lose that one game, lose the division and play Toronto, even though I would think that Florida wins a Toronto series in 5, maybe 6 games. And with Tampa, it's more of a coin flip and more of a 6-7 game series either way.
I want to start this discussion by thanking you for bringing that up, because there was a lot of talk last night about who are they going to play. And basically, like, the Panthers, once it became clear that Ottawa might actually beat Boston, that they were going to dictate, you know, who they could play. Like, if they wanted to play Toronto, they could. But for me, it came down to a couple of factors. The first thing is, and it comes to something you brought up, speaking of the 22 season and the game against Montreal, we know how they ended that season. They rested everybody. They gave up 10 goals in that game. And you have said, I don't know how much it actually played a role, but they went into the playoffs losing 10-2 or something. And we saw how difficult it was at times in the Washington series to get going, and then the Tampa series after that. Like, that is something to me that sticks in my mind, whether it had a huge role to play or not, because going into the playoffs winning means something. Going into the playoffs winning a division when you probably shouldn't have won the division considering how the standings were looking, that means something as well. And also, I think just from a fan perspective, like, the Panthers aren't yet to the point where winning a division doesn't mean anything. It's not like the Braves winning 14 straight division titles and winning one World Series. You know, this is only the fourth time they've won a division title. And yeah, those still mean something.
Division titles, I think, for anybody, whether I'm a Red Wings fan or, you know, a New York Rangers fan, or, you know, I have some friends who are New York Rangers fans, and I consider them smart, and they were excited to win the President's Trophy, excited to win their division, and they should be. I mean, it's not the be-all, end-all trophy, but, you know, you're not. It's not something that you don't want. You want to point to it. You want to be like, my team won the division, because you can only have so many victories. And you can only win so many things in the sport of hockey in the NHL.
It's basically four things you can win. You can win a division, you can win the President's Trophy, your conference, and then the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, and then the rest are individual awards or moral victories for the most part. But when it comes to...
Because you're not putting up a banner that says we won 50 games, you know. Maybe if you're the Predators, you would do that, but, you know.
Yeah, and division banners are not something to mock. I mean, like, no, that they've never been mocked. You know, I don't think a division banner's ever been mocked. I also don't think that they've really, unless you win the conference or the Stanley Cup, I don't think they do a ceremony where they raise it. I think it's just kind of there night one. At least in Philadelphia, that's how
it was there in Florida too. Like the last couple of years on opening night, they didn't even acknowledge that they won the President's Trophy or that they won the Eastern Conference. Yeah. It's just up there.
But I mean, it's still a banner. It's still something that's in your quote unquote trophy case. I mean, the amount of little tiny domestic, tournaments or, you know, things that professional soccer teams celebrate, like they've won the championship is, you know, so why can't we celebrate the division?
And as it came to opponent, because I think we need to get into this matchup because, well, it's not like we haven't been here before. To me, when I'm thinking about these two teams, it is interesting how a lot of people, to me, and I'm not saying that they're wrong. Again, you can fan however you want. I think this Toronto team is a better team right now than Tampa is. And I think the logo is playing a role and the playoff history is playing a role. And I've said on this podcast last year that the only thing that run was missing was beating the Lightning, because that's like the psychic overcoming of that barrier, right?
Yeah, but I mean, who would you rather play? Like, I mean, like in the playoffs, it's goalie is a huge part of it in a playoff series. Vasilevsky is probably still in the top three goalies you don't want to face in a series, because he can just win a series on his own, completely unaided, when he chooses to. And he's still in the window where he can do that. There's nobody, I don't think there's anybody on Toronto's roster that can win a playoff series all on their own.
This I 100% agree with, and Vasilevsky is the equalizer in this series, of course.
Tampa probably has 2.5 of those guys. That's a huge difference. Yeah, Toronto might be the better team at the end of this regular season, but are they... And again, I say all this as somebody who thinks and is picking Florida to beat Tampa in 6 games. So that I'm just going to get that out of the way. I think 6 games, Florida is going to beat Tampa. I think they're the better team. I'm not worried about it, but this is the matchup that I think you have the least confidence in, because there's 3 of the other teams that you could have played, you've beaten. You know, and or 2 of the 2 other teams you could have played, you've beaten, Boston and Toronto. So you have that confidence. You haven't beaten Tampa yet. they still kind of have that swagger, and they still have the impact players that Toronto hasn't proven to have in the postseason. Auston Matthews hasn't scored a goal in the postseason against Florida yet. You know, like, and he's their big impact player. Kucherov gives me nightmares in the playoffs, or has given us nightmares in the playoffs. Vasilevsky has given, you know, Florida players nightmares. They're beatable, 100% beatable. They come in as the underdog. Tampa is the underdog. But Florida, in their locker room, it's not going to be hard for them to adopt the underdog mentality at all. Tkachuk, you know, like, they're not going to have a hard sell getting the locker room to think they're the underdogs and they're going to have to play an underdog, chippy, dump the puck away game mentality to beat this team. And that this is a big prove yourself series for them.
That's a really good point about how they're going to internally frame it. I'm not sure that's how Paul Maurice is going to externally frame it, because look, you're right. They are the favorite in this series. They are the better team other than Vasilevsky. The Lightning are nowhere near as deep as they were in those two runs that they had against the Panthers. And I think there will be questions asked to Paul Maurice about how do you reference those two other series to this group? Because a lot of players in this room have been a part of one of them, if not both of them, and they know what happened. They're thinking about it. They're all aware of it. And they're going to be reminded of it constantly. But I think the difference is not just, you know, Paul Maurice is a better coach for this group right now than Andrew Brunette was, or even Joel Quenneville was at the time, even though that series they played in 21 was a found money happiness series that they got in and they're playing Tampa in the playoffs. I think the fact that you could easily frame this as an underdog because you've lost to Tampa twice, even though I think everyone knows they're the better team other than Vasilevsky, as we said, that makes it a series that falls neatly into the way they play and it will fall right into their wheelhouse, as opposed to Toronto, where everyone's going to talk about last year and how they're going to be the favorite again. And the other thing about Toronto that might persuade you that it would have been an easier, in air quotes, matchup is, this is how I would have framed that series if it happened, and maybe it still will in the second round. What did Toronto learn from how Florida beat them last year? They beat them in five. They were very close games. But what did Toronto learn? Because you saw what they tried to do, the chippiness, the, you know, little extra hacks and whacks after the whistle. Like, they're trying to be like that, but it's not really in their DNA. It's a lot of the, I don't want to say extraneous guys, but the biggest problem for the Leafs in many years was it's not imbued in their core guys to be chippy the way that Matthew Tkachuk is chippy. You know what I mean?
Here's why. They haven't lost going down fighting. And that's why I still wouldn't be worried about Carolina yet. I think for a lot of teams, now obviously there's always exceptions, but I think for a lot of teams to learn that chippiness, you have to basically lose in a way where you learn the lesson of you have to constantly push back. Like, it doesn't matter if you're getting embarrassed. It doesn't matter if it's over. It doesn't matter. You have to constantly fight to win. Even when you can't win, you still have to fight to win. And I think until you go through that and you just see that it's possible and you see, you understand what that means, I don't think you get it. I think Florida more so did that in their President's Trophy series against Tampa.
Well, I talked about a lot of this on this show before, yeah, that I think the Matthew Tkachuk trade obviously has worked out fabulously, but the first thought I had was, this is directed directly at the Tampa Bay Lightning. And I have said on this show, I've said it to Jeff Barrick, I've said it to everyone who will listen, that the Panthers-Lightning rivalry is one of the best rivalries in hockey right now, because the enmity comes from jealousy of what the Panthers want to have that Tampa already has, but also because Tampa did the thing that the Panthers are in the midst of doing, and Tampa has taught them how to do it. Their run last year, I think, was largely inspired because that group learned directly from those Lightning series. And what Tampa did to them is what they realized, we have to do it. Because Tampa proved that even when they're not anywhere near at their peak form, because their best team was the team that got swept by Columbus, they still found a way to manufacture all of that, right?
Yeah, but the best team wasn't the team that got swept by Columbus. Like, and that's what true. Like you have to just completely abandon the idea of what's good or what's bad or whatever, because Toronto isn't the better team than Tampa. It doesn't matter that they're in better form right now, and until they actually, like, I would not, and I don't think anybody, even the Toronto fans right now, are betting money on Toronto doing well this postseason. There's tons of Tampa Bay fans that are not worried at all. And Tampa in the locker room has not been worried since December, and it shows. And then maybe that's why they've been locked into the wild card spot, because they've just been like, it doesn't matter. Like, whether we play in the 2-3 matchup or we play as the wild card team against the one in our own division, it doesn't really matter. It's going to be basically about the same thing. It's just about winning the matchup, winning the head-to-head matchup. And the thing that they have and the thing that Florida has going for them, except against Tampa, but we'll see. With Tkachuk, it's a whole different ballgame. That's the wild card, right? And that's kind of obvious. But they know Florida knows they will do whatever it takes to win a matchup. Tampa, Toronto themselves, the players on Toronto, do not even know that they will do. They don't even know if they will do what it takes to win a matchup or not. They know that they beat Tampa and they were able to get through that, but then the loss to Florida and the way it does kind of
It definitely undid some of it, and this is not me picking on Leafs fans, because, again, I don't want to tell people how to fan, but I watched what Steve Dangle put out, and I think Steve Dangle is a very good barometer of what that fan base is thinking, or at least a good number of them are thinking, and I saw what happened at the end of last postseason and how they reacted to that loss in the series. I have not yet watched his video from the game last night. I really want to watch it because I get that that's going to probably be a good tell as to what that fan base is thinking. And I'm not saying that their brains got scrambled by the Panthers series, but their brains got a little scrambled by the Panthers series. Like, that did some damage to them from a fan perspective in the way of how they view the team. Because they won, and winning that first series was a big deal, and then it hit with a thud. Because they knew not only was it an opportunity missed, but that they didn't push back in a playoff-style way that the Panthers pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed the Leafs over. And that was the thing that got people really mad, because Toronto is in some ways like Philly. Like, they love Ty Domi, they love the tough, right. You know what I mean? And to see how it ended, just, it inflicted a little bit of damage on that market, and I'm not saying that in a bad way, it's just the phrase that I want to use. And the Tampa series is different, and I think Tampa's done a little of that to Florida too, but the Panthers responded in a different way to losing those two series in the ways that they did.
Yeah, and I think the big difference is, like, after the defeat in the second round, like, they have similar stories. Like, it took them forever to win a first round matchup. Then they did. Then they were quickly escorted from the playoffs against a team they really didn't want to lose to. But what Toronto hasn't done is use the regular season to do the things and show that they've learned the lesson. By the time the playoffs started last year, you could at least say Florida learned their lesson from Toronto. I mean, from Tampa. They learned their lesson, and they might not beat Boston because Boston's on a heater this year, but it's not going to be because they don't play playoff style hockey. They don't have the roster to do it. And they don't have the ability to stick to it and to play through it fight through the adversity, because not only did you just see an incredible 20-game run of them doing that, but you saw them intentionally building something from the beginning of the season, even if it wasn't working for half the season and you were like, come on, try something new and fire the coach and whatever, all the other stupid
which
stuff
is what
you
we
said.
Were saying on this podcast, yeah, to be fair.
For sure. But you at least, nobody was saying that they weren't trying to do what they said that they were going to do. We just were impatient and said that they were failing at doing it. And with Toronto, it's they've almost done a different flavor of what they usually do. They don't have Dubas, but they have Tree Living, and they're making some moves and they're doing all this stuff. But at the end of the day, they have a lot of overtime losses. They're relying on Matthews and Nylander to outscore their problems. The only person who really truly has a actual defensive commitment in their top six is Tavares, and he's the beating goat for the fan base. And
I think Matthews is a very underrated defensive player, but we don't hear about that enough,
No, I think we hear about it too freaking much. I'm tired of hearing Selke, Canada, and Matthews in the same sentence. And if you watch some of the plays, you'll see why. His little bank pass off the boards that turned into a scramble and everything, you do not see Selke candidates ever make that play, because they would have made a lot of other safer plays way before it got to that. But it's not about, oh, well, he just, you know, it took a funny bounce off the boards. That's a pass that a Selke candidate never makes, because I think we've forgotten what Selke is, because we've just chalked it up to Bergeron, and then without Bergeron, we don't know what it means. But the Bergerons, the Kopitars, the Barkovs, the Datsyuks, right? It's not just Bergeron. We know what it means. The Ron Francises, they are 100% committed to making the smart play 100% of the time. They will take offense off of their play to be on the defensive side of the puck, to make this defensive puck management decision with the puck. And that's what being a Selke candidate is. Matthews will never do that. Matthews will get his team to pull the goalie so he can chase 70, so he can sit out against Tampa the next game. That's why Toronto is different than Tampa and Florida, in my estimation, at a team level, and why Matthews at an individual level is not a Selke candidate, and why I still have questions about his impact role in the playoffs, even if you might be like, oh yeah, but he should score more than Barkov in the playoffs. He should, but against the big matchups, will he? And if he's not, can he be the big matchup? No, because if he's not scoring, he's going to be chasing the goals and taking the risks to get the goals that a Selke candidate doesn't take. Period.
I am going to predict some things for the playoffs. I'll hold off on them for now, because I do want to talk about the Panthers-Lightning series, though. Again, maybe all this will come back if the Panthers and Leafs do play again, which I think is a real possibility. The thing that I was saying about the Lightning is that they've actually not had good goaltending this year. Some of it is Jonas Johansson, our old friend, but Vasilevsky has not had the best year. Now, does that mean anything come the playoffs because it's Andrei Vasilevsky and that gets into your head? No. Nikita Kucherov's had an incredible season from counting stats perspectives. He's Nikita Kucherov. You know what he's going to do in the playoffs. The Lightning are just not as deep as they used to be. There are matchups that this team can get to. You know, they're going to load up their top two lines, and they're going to be good top two lines. And you're going to think about that top pairing of defensemen. You know, when you see Hedman out there, I think Chernak's going to play, but they're not going to have Sergachev. So you think about the depth and the Panthers and all the work they've done to build up that depth. You know, they've got three legitimately good lines that they're going to throw out there and are going to be so hard to beat when you go to Barkov, and then it's Bennett's line, and then it's Lundell, who, I mean, they didn't have this version of Lundell the first time he played in the playoffs against Tampa, but they have him now. And from a defensive point of view, like, even though you can quibble about some of their defensive depth and the way that is being utilized, they're just deeper than Tampa is right now. And I'm not saying the only way they can win that series is if Vasilevskiy steals it, because I don't think that's the case. I think that obviously on special teams and the fact that the Panthers still take a lot of penalties and Tampa can dine out on the power play, which they did in those first two series, is going to be something they have to be aware of, even though I think they're obviously a better penalty killing team than they used to be. And I also think that they're going to be a little smarter than they were in those first two series. But to me, like, what stands out to you most when you're thinking about this matchup other than goalie?
You named the two things. I mean, obviously the biggest thing is the goalie. Like, I know he might have a 900 flat right now save percentage, but we don't know if he's been coasting. If, like, he's been, if they've all just basically been like, everybody top out, like, your new 100% is 90% or whatever. And let's just get into the
There is no better team in the last 4 years of doing this in the regular season and then peaking in the playoffs. And last year against Toronto, they were probably the better team than Tampa is.
That's the biggest thing. The second thing is what you said, the power plays, because, and this would have applied to Toronto. It would have applied to a Boston because they have Pastrnak, they have McAvoy. They, you know, any team that, and pretty much any team in the NHL has an impact player on the power play that can feast out if they're hot and another team keeps giving them opportunities. So that's number two. But I think the third thing, and this is Tampa specific, is the mental edge and the little things. That's what put Florida over Boston in the end of it. Let them cruise over Carolina and Toronto in the second and third rounds, but they lost to Vegas because Vegas was able to get the luck of it, the big moments, or cash in the big moments before Florida did. And that's kind of, I think, how this series might come down to is, will Tampa continue their clutch time of just like basically playing off a counter strike and knowing that, like, all right, we're just gonna idle. Here's our thing, and now you're down 2-0 at the end of the first period, and you're on the road, and it's just like, oh god.
Do you know what reminds me of? You know what game I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of the game they played in Sunrise back in March, where the Panthers did some dumb stuff and we're down 4-1, and dominated so completely and utterly, but Vasilevskiy just stood on his head, and the Lightning were calm, even though they were getting caved in. You know, it was very much the worst of Tony Pulis's Stoke as a hockey team, and it worked.
So like I said, I brought up Tkachuk as the wild card, and that kind of is maybe what you want to call point or key three is Tkachuk. And, like, so Tampa is the mind games and the timing and the poise and whatever you want to call it, the man of the moment. They mastered that. Vegas mastered that against Florida too. And that was Florida's strength against the teams that they beat, was using that from Tkachuk. Is Tkachuk's addition versus Tampa enough to give Florida an edge in those mind games, in the after the whistle stuff, in the big moments where you know that everything is rising, the tide's rising, something's going to happen, everything feels like it's going to spill over? Is it going to be because Tkachuk gets a tip in goal, or is it going to be because Vasilevskiy makes a big save? Is it going to be Kucherov, doing a no-look shot on a 2-on-1? Is it going to be a Bobrovsky stoning Stamkos off a Kucherov sauce pass? Like, what is it going to be that sets it up? Because both of these teams, when they're their best in the playoffs, are basically capitalizing on those moments. Not only capitalizing on those moments, but creating the dichotomy between calm and chaos that gets those big moments to happen when they want them to. and to their advantage. So, like, I can't wait for this series. I'm nervous because it's closer to 50-50 than I wanted. I'm excited because, man, think of if Florida can win this, it will be just as good inside that locker room as beating Boston last year. It has the ability to project, to catapult, to fuel them to another deep run that may end up in the Stanley Cup, and God forbid something even better than a Stanley Cup final appearance. Like, that is the way you want to start a playoffs, because it's like, okay, we beat Tampa. We beat our demons. We beat the historic Boston Bruins last year. We beat in Carolina. We beat in Toronto. You know, who's next? Okay, maybe they haven't beaten New York, but after all of this, are you scared of New York? No. There's no one, I think, that is going to give them doubts moving forward if they can beat Tampa. If they can beat Tampa, then that matchup versus Vegas, if you get another rematch or you get an Edmonton, or, you know, the West is very talented. A couple of the best cup contending teams might all be out West. And, you know, you won't have any doubts because you've taken down Tampa. So if it's a Vegas rematch, you know, you can beat those punks because, it's hard to talk when thinking about losing to Vegas last year.
I know.
but this really is a team where, like, they can do it. Yet they certainly can lose. They certainly can lose in this first round or any of the rounds after. But they most certainly will be in favorites in a lot of these matchups. And I believe in their ability to come out on top.
You know what's interesting to me, because now that we've been thinking about it for, you know, 20 minutes or so, is my whole framing of the Leaf series was going to be, what has Toronto learned from the series they played last year? What have they internalized? What are they going to do differently than they did a year ago? And the Panthers are obviously a very different team than the one that last lost to Tampa. But I think that everybody inside that building is thinking, like, what are we going to do differently that we didn't do the first two times we lost to them?
What does Maurice and Tkachuk bring? What does Barkov calm down? Like, that, it, like, what does Barkov and Bobrovsky?
What was the turning point of the first Tampa series? It was the Bennett suspension. Like, what has Sam Bennett learned from that? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those are good points. I mean, I think that's kind of bundled up into the penalties and that kind of stuff. But if I'm being honest, people won't like hearing this, but the suspensions and some of those penalties are all determined by the flow of play and the narrative that's in the media and all that stuff. And it's going to be much different because Tampa's already done their thing. They're not the NHL favorites anymore. They're going to have to do it on merit. And Florida may very well be the NHL's choice if there is one, and they might get some more calls, or they might not get some of the negative media framing that can kind of compact and certainly influence officials who, you know, across all sports are very easily influenced or very easily incompetent.
I always choose to believe in Hanlon's razor and Occam's razor, but
I choose to believe in Angel Hernandez.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. The other avenue in this series that I wanted to talk about is the first time they played, they had no confidence in their goaltending. The Bobrovsky series 2 years ago, he was not the reason why they lost. I think we can all fundamentally agree on that. The goaltending is different, obviously, because this season is the best Panthers goaltending season we've seen in a really long time. I think they're confident in playing both. Like, there might be a moment in which you even think about giving Stolarz a game, even if you're not, you know, because there's going to be all this talk about goalie rotations. Like, they might, the Bruins might do it, but to me, I'm riding Bobrovsky until the wheels fall off. But
I will say this. I've said this ever since the Flyers had issues with the goalie carousel in the playoffs, and that is when you take a goalie out in the playoffs, if it's in the middle of a game, you can go back to him to start the next game. But if you start the backup in the game afterwards, you're basically saying it's your net the rest of the way.
I made that point a lot 3 years ago when they changed to Drieger and then they changed to Spencer. And I'm like, once you made the first change in goal, you were cooked. The second change, it was pure desperation.
But you can't, and then they go back, and it's one of those things where I don't think you go back unless it's like you're pulling the goalie to wake up the team. It's not Bobrovsky's fault, you know. You're pulling him up, or maybe he's having a bad day, a bad game, but you know you're going back to him next game. And one of the first things you tell him when he comes off the ice is like, we're going back to you next game. He'll, you know, then the other goalie, you know, throws a shutout. You have some issues and you might have to walk things back, but whatever. The biggest, you know, that's my thing.
What happened last year when they pulled Lyon in game 3 against Boston? It was Bobrovsky the rest of the way, even though he wasn't great in the Boston series. He wasn't, but they got him the confidence. And then we saw what happened after that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you're not you're more like Boston in this scenario than Florida last year, where you're basically going to ride the guy until game 7, like where things have basically gone to shit and you have no other option. Because I mean, at the end of the day, you're paying Bobrovsky $10 million on the salary cap every year. You may be losing Spencer Knight as a cap casualty because of this in the offseason. And you have no reason not to believe in him after last year.
And
this regular season. So what could you possibly – I mean, Stolarz has been great, but I don't think he's been good enough like where he was Lyon, where Alex Lyon, all right, he was good enough where he started a couple games. So I really don't think Stolarz is prepared to play in any of these rounds. And if he does, he's going to play very free because he knows he's playing with house money at that point.
I would agree with that.
You know, Bobrovsky has every chance to be the better goalie in this series, and that's why he's making $10 million, and that's why he drove him to a final appearance last year. But he doesn't need to. Vasilevsky needs to be the better goalie for Tampa to have a chance.
Another really, really good point. If the Lightning win, Vasilevsky had to be the better goalie. If the Bob Panthers win, Bobrovsky does not have to be the better goalie. That is a good point.
He just has to be a good version of himself. And he has to get progressively more consistent and more, more of himself, like in that Boston series where he grew with confidence every game. If that's the case, I think they'll get good enough goaltending. It's really about, you know, the Florida defense. I think the Florida defense is a key because not only will it help with defensively with Bob and everything, but I think they've shown it's a key part of the offense. Even if they're not getting points and getting points in the same manner that they were in the President's Trophy year or even, you know, Montour last year, when the defense is playing tight and when the defense is playing well as a group, they're owning so much of transitional play that there's an element of burden off of the wingers that they can devote to scoring an offense. And there's also the additional chances that's being added where just by a numbers game, you get more goals. So for me, this is a big playoff series for Mikola. Is he, I mean, he needs to be somebody who's does his role well so that Montour, Forsling, and others can do what they do. And, you know, it's going to take every single player, and I think it's going to take seven defensemen. Like, I think there's definitely going to be seven defensemen used in this series, whether injuries or not. I think you need to give different looks. I think you need to be using them. And with the way Belinsky's is playing, I don't know how he's not going to get at least a game in this series at home or something.
Yeah, I would think he'd probably give him a game at home where you can dictate the matchup, because, like, if you're looking at that Panthers defense core and you're John Cooper and the advanced scout, you're probably thinking, oh, okay, we're going to target Ekman, Larson, and Kulikov, because, I mean, you always target the other team's third pair, but also, like, you can get at those guys, and Belinskis offers something a little different. And on the Belinskis front, by the way, we would be remiss if we didn't mention that the Panthers signed two players from the Czech League, because whoever the scout was that found them, Ubis Belinskis, who has been very good and is going to be a part of that group next year, they're like, yeah, go get whoever you want. You have free range. And they found a giant defenseman and a forward. So very good work by them. That's how this team should be run. And it's incredible that we said for years, just go out and find European free agents. I'm sure you can do it. And they did it. And it's worked. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we say, like, that cap space or lack of assets were not an excuse to not be able to improve the defenseman, that's what we meant. Like, it may take a year or two, you know, for it to come into fruition. Signings in April may not really start paying off until the following April. But, you know, if when you do these things regularly, you seem to always have things available when you need them.
Well,
or at least have
lottery
the
tickets. If you don't have draft picks, these are lottery tickets.
But I think when you scout pros and stuff, and you scout guys who are undrafted and a little bit older, it's better than a lottery ticket. I think you are almost investing in a startup where there's a little bit more skill involved than just luck. And you definitely can be a little more reliant on it than even draft picks. So in that sense, if you believe what I'm saying, then this is even more important than having fifth, sixth, and seventh, you know, round picks.
Well, I mean, one thing we could say about the Panthers under the newly extended Bill Zito, something else we didn't mention until just now, but obviously richly deserved. Their pro scouting has been exceptionally good. Like, their pro scouting has been on point since they came in, and you don't need us to rehash the evidence. It's right in front of you. And also, Bjornfoot, too, is another player who I don't think he's going to play much in the playoffs, if at all. But, like, he's another guy for down the line that they're investing in and they're going to give a chance to in the future. And you have every reason to believe that they know what they're doing when they do something like that.
Yep. Yep. And when it comes to the pro scouting, is it because Zito, when they made the change, Zito brought in new guys who are better than the old guys? Maybe. But I think a lot of it just has to do with leadership and the empowerment that you were talking about and referencing when you were talking about, hey, Uvis is paying off. Go find us some more guys, and here's X amount of dollars, or here's how many contracts we're willing to spend on give you this year. And at the end of the year, you give us our guys, and if we like them, we'll sign them. And, you know, but I think it's the empowerment. I think it's also giving clear guidelines. I think a lot of teams have an idea of what makes a good hockey player, the traits. Do they put it into a easily repeatable and readable template or profile or, you know, process that the scouts can go out and be like, yes, this when Zito says X, Y, and Z, this is what he means, and this is how I can put what I can match what I see on the ice into this model, and everybody, you know, will be happy. Because if you're just going out and telling scouts to just pick give you their favorite players or to pick guys that they like and everything, you know, without so much of a model of these are the type of defensemen we're looking for. These are the traits, and this is how, this is what we want to see on the ice, and this, and getting the buy-in from those scouts on the ground all the way up through the amateur scouting directors, the front office, assistant GMs, general managers, and now the himself, chief president, Zito. And I do just want to point out, I did see a lot of texts like, wasn't Caldwell the president? Caldwell is the president of the business operations, and Zito is president of the hockey operations. So they will have different reports.
Yeah, no, they're different. They're different structures. As they probably like, he reports to Matt Caldwell, but like the hockey ops is not any way tied to the business side, which is how it should be. The other thing that I've mentioned before that I don't know whether it will end up happening in the future, but like, I've always thought in the back of my mind that there is a chance that Zito ends up taking full-time president of hockey ops and it doesn't do the day-to-day GM stuff, you know, the way that Joe Sakic and George McPhee and people like Jim Rutherford, you know, Jeff Gorton, these are the kinds of things I'm thinking about. I think he likes the day-to-day GMing more than those other guys did, but I wonder when, if that ever happens. Like,
I think you're 100% right, and I want to give you another data point on why you're right. This is his first job. He's not even been a GM for 5 years. Think about it yourself. Like, we all love being armchair GMs, whether it's through fantasy sports or video games or just fandom like we do on this podcast here. Would you give it up in less than 5 years for a less involved role?
And I think about what's his role compared to all these other guys that I'm mentioning. Jim Rutherford's been a GM since the Stone Age, pretty much. Jeff Gorton was a general manager in New York, and it didn't work. McPhee had all of Washington and then Vegas. And Joe Sakic, obviously, is the most famous player in the history of the Colorado Avalanche in many respects.
Right.
So, like, it's different for Bill Zito and why he might like the day-to-day more. And this is just me guessing. It's not me reporting it. It's just thinking about it, because the Panthers have guys in their organization, not the least of which, who I think the successor is, which is Roberto Luongo, but also Brett Peterson, you know, Kropelka. They've got a really good front office there. And what has things have surprised me is that we haven't seen the Panthers lose anybody yet. Like, one of those, you know, things that happens in good organizations is your smart assistant general managers, your smart scouts get promotion somewhere else, and you let them go because that's how good organizations are run, and you backfill. Yeah. It hasn't happened yet with the Panthers, but I want, and not that Bill Zito's ever going to leave, because I don't think that's going to happen, but you know what I mean?
Here's my thought. I think we will, whether this summer or next summer, we will lose somebody. I'm not in a rush to do it, but I think, you know, maybe we lose Peterson, maybe we lose somebody else. I think you're right. We don't lose Luongo. We would only probably lose him to Vancouver, and I don't see that happening with
the Canucks. To be a complete dumpster fire under this management group, and the fact that this year they won a division and won 50 games gives them a lot of leeway.
Zito's 59. I think he's got 3 more years at least of wanting to be full-time, hands-on, before he thinks about transitioning over a couple years into a full-time president's role. So, I mean, that would be my guess. I think he's got a lot of energy and he's got a lot of skill and he's worked very hard to get here. So I think he's going to want a couple more years of doing all the stuff and holding all the strings in his hand. After that, I think Luongo is going to have a shot, and over these next 3 years, he's going to get more and more. They're going to lose somebody. Luongo is going to pick up those responsibilities, pick up that, you know, that move up a slot, so to speak, in the pecking order, and all of that. They're probably going to bring in new guys that are going to challenge Luongo for that spot, or could be, you know, guys from Europe or something, or, you know, who could have a say. Maybe it's a guy like Sergei Fedorov, who's not going back to his KHL team, and there's
maybe it's Patrick Hornquist, even, like, if he wants to get more into the front office. Like, good organizations have that happen, you know.
And like, that's the thing. Like, I think with you the best if as long as Zito is still the best person for the job and wants to do the job and has the capabilities to do the job, all things I think will be true for the next 3 years beyond this. You know, he will be doing it. I'm not worried about it. I think it's going to be good. I think it's good for other people to leave and get success. It's going to bring more candidates into Florida, thinking like I can come in here, do good work for 2 to 3 years, and be a candidate if I can't move up inside the organization. Because you want it to be competitive. You want it to be selective inside the organization. Because that means you're one of the best, which means you lose some very good candidates, you know.
Unless you're Columbus, in which case you had all of this talent and lost it anyway. And what did that get you? I want to make one other point that before we tie up this section to go to the other stuff that we got to get to, and we do have other stuff we want to get to, is that even if they lose to Tampa, and it's going to suck if they lose to Tampa, I mean, let's be honest, or if they lose early at any point, you know, because the expectations are all, at this point, pretty much cup or bust, because they can win the Stanley Cup. Like,
I think the expectations definitely are make it to the third round.
Yeah, but the Stanley Cup playoffs are very hard. You don't know what's going to happen. But this organization is set up to repeat the success over and over again because they have, as we've talked about, the structures in place with Zito, with everybody else, the processes in place that are finding them players. You can trust, and there's enough of a track record now where you can trust that they are going to do the right things. Even if you see a move in the offseason, you're like, huh, I don't quite get that. All right. You know what I mean?
But like, all right, but I think we should just stick to more. So like, Zito's great and everything, but...
Yeah, I understand that. I'm not projecting that they're going to lose, and I'm not saying, like, this is how you should act if they lose, but, like, the organization is set up to, even if there's a setback, like, they'll find their way out of it and do better in the future because
everything's
set up to do this in the ways that we see. Do I think the... I have not made my predictions yet. I have to think about it a little more, but I am leaning...
What do you have to think about? It's the Florida...
I'm talking about my entire Stanley Cup playoff predictions, not just this series. I'm leaning to the Panthers winning this series because of what's different to years ago, as opposed to like losing your mind in the whole Tampa.
Put on the fan hat.
One prediction I will make. I think Toronto does beat Boston this year. I do think the Leafs beat the Bruins.
The Florida Panthers will never have a superstar like Sasha Barkov again. Every superstar coming forward will not be taking those pay cuts, will not be that humble, will not be that rooted to the community, will not be, you know, and I just put on the fan hat. That's one of my biggest pleas is, going into it this year, we have a little bit more appreciation of what this team is capable of doing on the ice and a little more trust in that they will fulfill that capability. So I think we can put on the fan hat and say, rhyme or reason, Florida can win this series. They're going to do it. If they get down in the series or in a game, keeping that faith, believe. Keep doing all the stupid, silly superstitions and all that stuff because, like, you know, this isn't the young Tampa Bay team we're used to, and this is our time, and this core, like, just believe. That's my biggest thing. Like, we can talk about matchups. We can talk about third line versus third line and all this stuff, but it would all come down to, on paper, I think Florida has the better edge, if in all seriousness.
Mm-hmm. And now we must move on to other fun, beautiful topics.
They did it. They did it. The Flyers did it, baby. And not only that, they did it in a tight Eastern Conference race where they played meaningful hockey all the way to the third period of Game 82. But there's still like two teams at least between them and a playoff spot. So they get a couple picks earlier. So I think if Minnesota picks up a point tonight, they will pick 12th. I'm not sure if Minnesota needs to even pick up a point or not.
They play tomorrow. They play tonight when you're listening to this, first day, yes. Hold on. I'm going to look to my great friends at the website Tankathon.
Yeah.
So let's look.
I think, well, if I don't remember the tiebreakers, but looking at the rows and all that, Minnesota has more rows. So I think once they do play that game, the Flyers are maybe locked into 12th.
I think the Flyers are locked into 12th, yes, no matter what happens.
12th overall is good. I mean, a week ago, you were thinking that they were drafting possibly in the high teens or even 20, 21. So this is great.
Let's talk about how it happened. Great. Because we talked on the last show when they were skidding, but it wasn't this yet, about the misalignment between Briere and Tortorella and some of the things we were seeing. Now, the reason why they lost the playoff spot was not because of this misalignment, so to speak. It was because they didn't get a save. You know, they have... I mean, Ersson clearly ran out of gas.
Yeah, Ersson ran out of gas. Sandstrom isn't that good, and he ran out of gas.
And Fedotov, I'm happy they got him in.
Well, he already played a full season. He already played a full season and came in too late. So what are you going to do? Same with the other Russian goalie that Kolesov came off. So, you know, what are you going to do? I think another thing is that Tortorella isn't the type of guy. He's the type of guy who can wring blood from a stone. But when you wring blood from a stone and then it stops, what else can you do? You know, that was your trick. You know, his trick was getting the absolute, was maxing out on this group. And he maxed out on the group and it wasn't good enough because they couldn't do it 82 games. You know, I don't think it's a failure of Tortorella, but I think it's a limitation to him. And it's why, as much as I'm probably one of his biggest defenders of modern hockey fans, I always say that he agrees, he's a shorter lifetime coach. Like, he's got 3 or 4 seasons in him and he's done, which means Philadelphia should be looking for his replacement. And I'm going to say it here before anybody else does. Carl, University of Denver. Carl, University of Denver. Carl, University of Denver. Bring him in. You know, that would be, I think, a great fit for him. It's a big organization that can pay him big money. He's going to have a role. He's going to, you know, be able to come in either as an assistant to Tortorella, knowing that Tortorella is heading upstairs and that's kind of already been in the works and is definitely happening. And Tortorella's voluntarily gone upstairs for some games to start that transition at times. And I think he fits what Philadelphia needs to do to take what Ed Schneider wanted, what Tortorella's preaching, and what Keith Jones and Briere want to do, and kind of blend it into a message that players of this day and age will want to hear. Because that's, I think, Tortorella's biggest issue, is he doesn't maybe have the social grace or the social skills to handle players nowadays to get the desired results. And as we get, as the game goes younger and younger, and as we get more and more into, the next generations, that's just going to be a necessity. You can talk about whether you like it or dislike it or all of that, but you know, as new generations enter the workforce, workforces must change to meet those generational needs and expectations, because they're the workforce. They're the ones you need to get the most out of. And if you can't, you will be out of a job. And I think that's what's going to eventually happen to Tortorella. You watch, you know, 2 national championships in 3 years for Carl at University of Denver. I think he's a guy that has preached culture, has made culture, has gotten kids to buy into, men to buy into this, put it onto the ice, win multiple championships, and I think he's ready to move forward. I think, you know, it might not be this year, but I think when he sees the offer that he wants to take, he's ready to take it now. And if I'm Philadelphia, I want to be one of those teams. Heck, if I'm Florida, I want to be one of those teams, because you know Maurice isn't going to be here forever. Be like, do you want to learn under Paul Maurice as an associate head coach under Paul Maurice for a couple of years and be the de facto guy to take over when he retires to, you know, follow his play-by-play son on the road for a year, whatever he wants to do.
My joke is, it's like, I would always want to ask him, which is like, how do you want to coach long enough for your son to be asking you questions on the broadcast? And I don't know what the answer to that is going to be. But on the subject of Carl, I was thinking about that because obviously Carl, there's a last name. I think there might be a connection to the Flyers, and somebody can remind me of that.
Yeah, it's his brother, Matt Carl.
I know. I was making the joke about it, but that's all right. To me, I think about, for Torts, like, the thought I had watching this collapse and knowing it's not really Torts' fault, although, yeah, there are players that are tired. The biggest problem...
It's like Brunette. It wasn't his fault, but he was also incapable of fixing it. And in the moment, it's the head coach's job to fix it.
You are correct when you say that. And I think, to me, the Flyers overachieved. They shouldn't have been as good as they were. Their underlying numbers were not bad. They played a good style of hockey, but they didn't have finishers in the areas they needed to have finishers. They had some injuries at times, and that really hurt them. And when they needed saves, they didn't get saves. And the biggest thing that I can say that they didn't do all that well, and perhaps there wasn't anything you could do about that, they said that they were prepared in case something happened with Carter Hart, and something did happen with Carter Hart. He will not play in the NHL again anymore after what he's been charged with, and that is correct. But the Flyers, since that happened, have just not had the goaltending. And it is to be said that you can only do so much in preparation for that. And, like, you only know when it happens, like, is Sam Ersson going to be able to shoulder this load, essentially? And it's clear from this game, not just, you know, the final stretch, and he was perfectly cromulent in some of the games they won down the stretch, but he wasn't ready for that.
Did they prepare to lose Hart in a year where games 65 to 82 were meaningless? Because I think part of the reason Ersson ran out of gas was the mental fatigue. He had to be a game changer on a nightly basis to keep the playoff hopes alive from the middle of the year on, after being, you know, after not really, maybe he was prepped, like, hey, you know, he was prepped to be a starter by the year's end. But I don't, you know, I think
you have made a lot of good points on this podcast, and that's another one you made. Like, is Sam Ersson being prepared to be a goalie for a team that's not expected to be good, right, and then is thus thrust into a role, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, they could have prepped him to play more games than, you know, he played last year, and, you know, they were like, okay, the number of games he needs to play, given the timeline we think this is all going to happen, he can play those amount of games. What they found out through practice this year, which happens, as you said, you know, you never really know until it happens, is that he couldn't play that amount of games in when the game, when he had to be a difference maker every night and playoff hopes were on the line and they were in and out of the playoff picture, you know, sometimes multiple times a week, you know, that is a grind. And if it's your first time doing it in an 82 game season, and for a lot of Europeans, you know, they don't play anywhere close to that. And if you're coming out of college, you definitely didn't play close to that. You know, so I think for that's a big thing. And I'm not going to beat up the Flyers on that too much. I think, you know, not being prepared to motivate a team in another way or not figure out a way to give Ersin a break. And maybe it's, and like things like this, Tortorella had too much pride to just play Sandstrom a couple games in a row and give Ersin a break. If he did that early enough in the season, could you have gone back? Could you have played Ersin more heavier down the stretch? You know, maybe it was all, you know, adding in that third goalie coming in and know you had to give him starts and everything. And maybe there was just too many moving pieces, but whatever it was, it didn't seem like they had enough levers to pull, and they put themselves on a path where they had to walk a tightrope all 82 games, but they didn't have the tools and the levers to get them through that. Now, yeah, they could have known that and said, hey, this is still the better way, because at least we're preparing them for what they need to do. And at least we can say, it's not your fault, guys. It's, you know, the team isn't built up enough yet. It's not your fault, guys. You haven't done this enough yet. You know, and at the end of the season, Tortorella, you know, it's after 82 games. There's no way Tortorella didn't go into that locker room and say he's proud of them. Like his message now is, you gave me everything. I pushed you as hard as I could all year, and you gave me everything. It didn't work out, but you know.
And I think that is nothing. There's nothing wrong with saying, like, look, I mean, they all knew what the expectations were internally. And then we also knew, like, they've overachieved, and they gave everything they had in the season where they had some challenges, like, big challenges. And they found a way to do that in a year that was the first year of a rebuild. Now, the unfortunate thing for the Flyers is they finished 12th, which is the first spot where you can't actually win the draft lottery and get to the number one overall pick. You can only go high as 2, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is.
Well, but they have 2 chances to get second overall.
True. They do have 2 chances to get second overall.
That's basically how you have to look at it. There's 3 different separate drawings. They can win third, they can win second, and if they win first overall, they get second overall.
I thought that they only do draws for 1 and 2 now. I thought that's how they did it. I'll have to look that up. But either way, you're right. They have 2 chances to win second.
It's the same thing. Yeah, it's 2 chances to win second. And second, you're getting another Russian in Demidov, who there are people who say he's better than Mishkov. Because he might not be as game-breaking at times, but he's more consistent. He maybe does, you know, things that might be more NHL playoff style, translatable or whatever. You know, there's different reasons, but, you know, that's a number 2 option. I mean, because Celebrini's going 1. I think that's pretty clear. I think everybody's in an agreement there. So, you know, that would be your number 2 pick, or defenseman Dickinson, or, you know, one of the other defensemen, or I wouldn't be upset with 2. If you're the Flyers and you go from 12 to 2, I don't think you're thinking about, oh man, if only they were 11th, they could have got first. Well, if they 11th, they wouldn't have had that winning number. You know,
true.
There's so many ways you can nitpick it.
Can I ask a couple questions about, like, what does this offseason look like for the Flyers? Because it is curious to me. I don't think they're going to let go of Tortorella. I think they give him one more year.
No, I think they – well, I don't think they're going to let go of Tortorella. I think that Tortorella is going to move upstairs. And I think you're right. He at least has one more year, because unless it's David Carl saying, I'm only coming to Philadelphia ever. Like, if you don't give me the head coaching job next year, I'm never coming to Philadelphia, which I can't imagine Comcast Spectacor reacting positively to that. But especially after the Cutter Gauthier situation, I don't think he's an actual option this year. And again, next year you want to lose. Mishkov is not going to be there. You want to lose. Draft pick again. That, you know, you're at the beginning of the rebuild. Draft pick again. And so if you get on a heater, you treat it the same like you treated it this year. You do what you allow Tortorella to preach a winning mentality and do the things to build a culture. And Briere just manages his ducks to allow that to happen. And then at the trade deadline, he does what he has to do after talking to Tortorella, and they move forward. And that is how I think you're going to have to rebuild. I saw a great point, and I don't know who to credit it to because it was some jabroni on Twitter. but he was saying that, you know, in reference to Buffalo, you know, they fired their coaches, and Ottawa saying 3 years ago that they were – you know, out of the rebuild phase, and look how that's been going for them and stuff, is everybody goes through a rebuilding time. And if you look at recent examples, rebuilding hit a peak about 7 years ago, and all the teams that did it all at the same time, only so many teams can, like, have success. So the more teams that do it, the more failures you're going to have, because you're not going to increase the number of successes, because success means being a contender. And there's always going to be contenders who never get bad. And then there's only so many contenders. So, you know, that's just the way it works. So it's not that rebuilding's bad, but there's so many ways to do it, and you have to be good at it. You have to be good at anything to be successful. So to be good at rebuilding, you have to do things a different way, and you have to do it differently. If you're all rebuilding the same, you're not really going to get out in front of them. The Flyers, to their advantage, are at least rebuilding different, and they have that. And I think by allowing Tortorella another year, allowing Briere and Jones to manage the way that they managed this year and work, you know, towards getting Mishkov over, I think they will rebuild the best way for Philadelphia. But if you have to pick playoffs or draft. Just one more time.
Let me ask this question to you here, because I am intrigued by a couple things when it comes to the Flyers and just the roster, but also, as you said, with coaching, like, how many teams are going to be in the market for a head coach this year? A ton. Do you want to be swimming in some of those ponds? And you mentioned David Carl. Like, he's going to be one of the hottest coaching candidates, I think, this year, next year. And he has the luxury of picking his spot and knowing, I've got a very safe fallback option in winning another national title at Denver if I want to. You know, this is an interesting talking point for him. So maybe he comes out this year, but if you're a team like New Jersey, you're probably not looking at, you know, a David Carl type, a first-time head coach, when your group is matured enough and already has playoff experience. The Sabres aren't going to do that. They want a guy who already has coaching experience. And then you've got St. Louis, you've got all these other teams that are going to be out there. Like, David Carl, if you set it up right, if that's who you really want, then your idea could be, let's set ourselves up to get David Carl right as we are actually out of the rebuild and trying to win. And so then David Carl doesn't have to, you know, have the bumpy landing. You know what I mean? if that's what they want to do. I don't know if it's what they want to do or not, but since Carl has the connections to the Flyers organization, and this is also why I just don't think they're going to fire Tortorella now, because it doesn't really make a lot of sense when you're going to be swimming in a pond with a bunch of other teams. And I don't know if they really wanted to, and there could be playoff changes. Look, the Leafs could fire Sheldon Keefe if the playoffs go bad, so like there could be even more craziness to come after that. This is my thought.
The Flyers want to do something very specific. They want to take Broad Street Bullies and put it into a winning formula for the new generation. That's, they've stated it in their marketing and everything like that. They think Tortorella is a big piece of that. They think, you know, because of Tortorella's bluntness and his willingness to say he's wrong, his willingness to try new things and to take more of a mentor and consultant role over time makes him a big part of this. So you might think he's like Dale Tallon blueprinting it, and he kind of is, but I think, you know, a guy like Carl would be a good fit, but I think they don't need Carl. They just need one of the up-and-coming coaches that fits what they're trying to do and wants to be a part of it and wants to be one of those coaches. And, you know, I think you're 100% right. It makes more sense to make a coaching change closer to coming out of the rebuild than right now. And that might be something that Buffalo hasn't had the patience of doing and maybe didn't have the luck of having a more positively perceived playoff run down the stretch of April and March.
Than like the Red Flyers Wings did? Had.
Yeah, the Red Wings or the Flyers or, you know, Buffalo has not really had the goodwill because of their own failures of, you know, some of that good positive goodwill of like, oh, they almost made it in a year they shouldn't have. The Sens probably had too much of that and made them.
Well, they're always the champions of if the gold plan existed, they'd get a lot of number one overall picks because they always do well after they're eliminated. But I also want to talk about the roster for a second, just in quickly before we move on to the Coyotes. Yeah. It is, to me, the big question. Yeah, the big question for me is, we talked about goaltending. I think they need to get a guy who can help Ersson grow a little bit more. That's number one. Now, if you look at their cap-friendly page, they don't have a ton of cap space, but that's fungible. They'll make it. You know, they'll buy some people out. They'll move guys around. Ellis will go on LTIR, things like that. But to me, it's where do they want to take this swing? Because if you're talking about rebuilding, then you're going to do a lot more of the Ryan Palings and Garnet Hathaways as opposed to something a little different. Are you expecting more internal growth? I think the biggest thing you have to do is get a goalie, because it's clear that Ersson can't do this on his own. And I think Fedotov is somebody who they'll probably keep around, but he's a guy I think you've got to give him a lot of North American minutes.
Yeah, I agree with you in theory. But I don't think you can have that many goaltenders, and they have two goaltenders that need NHL minutes next year to keep them both viable. So I think I think what you got to do is say, we have to go with Ersson and Fedotov, and, you know, if we need to pick a goalie off of waivers, a vet goalie, we can always do that. There's always some, you know, Jonas Johansson is always available by trade, for the most part, or, you know, a goalie of like that. If
Spencer you're willing Martin.
If you're willing to overpay, and turn a seventh or a sixth into a fifth, you can get a lot of teams, you know, goalies, unless, you know, if you pick the right teams. A team like Florida, they obviously are not like, they're not one of these teams to ask this about right now, because like their third goalie, Spencer Knight, and, you know, or Stolarz, depending how you look at it, but they're needed because of some contextual issues. But like, so I don't worry about that. I think what they need to do is start opening up the phone lines and start really thinking of, we are in the state of our keep list needs to be a lot smaller than our open to possibilities list. And it's not so much a like untouchable and a trade list. It's more of a, these are guys we want to keep for next year for a myriad of reasons, because we want to grow their value more. We think that they're worthwhile in the locker room or whatever it would be, their skill set, whatever. And, you know, that's a guy I think is, you know, a guy like Farabee is a keep. A guy who's in the possible considerations is Konechny, is Morgan Frost, is, you know, Scott Laughton. You know, those guys are the possibles. You don't necessarily want to trade them, and they're fine if they stay. But, you know, anybody who's not going to be here and be able to contribute meaningfully to winning when Mishkov is expected to win playoff rounds, trade them. Trade them now while they're younger and have more value versus trading them at 32 or 31.
And the other part of this is there's a lot more cap space in the league this year, because not only is the cap going up, but a certain team's going to spend more. So
how many teams are going to want Travis Konechny based on the way he plays? Like, if it's a copycat league, if Florida and Vegas, if that way of playing hockey is in demand, if Tyler Bertuzzi and that kind of stuff is in demand, Konechny is a better Bertuzzi, in my opinion. And that's somebody that he doesn't want to leave. He's my favorite flyer on the roster right now. How do you trade him? That feels so stupid. But at the end of the day, what you're going to get for him is going to be needed and meaningful for the rebuild. If you trust your people. Now, people are always like, yeah, well, that second or the first round pick could not work out. Okay, well, then it's a waste. If that's how you're thinking, then keep Travis Konechny, because an old Travis Konechny is going to be better than your cynicism. But if you think you have the scouts that know what the plan is, like, if Philadelphia thinks that they're getting to the Florida level of trusting their pro scouts, of that communication and stuff, their amateur scouts, to bring in guys that they can use, and I personally think they should trust them more than not trust them. The guys that they've been bringing in since Fletcher, have been drafting since Hextall, have been getting better and better. And I've liked most of their more picks than not. The free agents, the trades and everything, it's getting more focused, and I think it's getting better. Ryan Poehling was a great one. I like the Denis Garionov pickup. I think that's going to pay dividends next year if they keep him. I hope they keep him. Some of that stuff. Now, I have some doubts. Jamie Drysdale, I have doubts about, but maybe that was the best package. So you have to take the best package, because you already know that context.
You're already behind the eight ball with that trade. We've talked about that this season.
I think making the moves like Zamula, he's young, but he's 24, and in 4 years, I don't think he's good enough to stay. Like Nick Seeler, you already have your locker room guy, your third pair to block shots, whatever, so that you don't need the marks. You don't need to sign a veteran or anything for that. But like Cam York and Jamie Drysdale are the only defensemen I'm not trading. I'm not like they're in the keep. Everybody else is in the possible move. I'm trying to look at Oliver Bonk, maybe I don't trade, but everybody else I'm willing to hear, but probably even Oliver Bonk, I'm willing to hear what the offer is, willing to talk about it.
They need to just commit to their vision, and like, if they get into the playoffs, it's a bonus, but right now, like this year would have been a bonus if they got into the playoffs, but you're trying to lay the foundations and get the alignment right, because for so many years that just didn't exist. This is a Flyers team that needs to figure that out and is still trying to figure it out. And
yeah.
Look, I think they've made strides. It is very hard, especially when you're in a grouping of teams. There are a lot of good teams out there. You know, there aren't many gimmies.
Noah Cates is on a good contract, but when he's off the contract, he's arbiter eligible, and he's already 25 right now. Like, and he's making 2.6. Like, maybe, like, yes, it'd be, he can be valuable, but he's not so valuable that I wouldn't trade. And same with Owen Tippett's a keep because you just signed that contract, but I hope the Flyers sign that contract to trade that contract. I think Owen Tippett helps you score the goals and create the excitement for tickets and stuff you need for the next couple of years. But then you trade him to get younger pieces or pick or replenish picks,
I mean,
or
you've
whatever.
Got guys like Brink, you've got Forster, who had a really nice season.
Brink and Forster are keeps. Tippett's a keep for this year, but like Hathaway, Frost, Lawton, I mean Konechny.
I think they need to trading Lawton, right?
Yeah.
Feels like that's gonna happen.
They should have taken the first round pick for him last year. That was
probably
silly.
But the other thing they have is they have a lot of picks. They've got Florida's pick, they've got their own first, which is probably gonna be 12th or 13th. So they can move around. They've got an extra second, so
the next 2 years, they have two firsts and two seconds.
So they've got some things that they can move around and use to get better now, even if they don't really need to get better now.
I don't think so. You're not – when you're trying to get better, like, I think you're looking for what Florida was looking for in the early parts. You're looking for guys – you're going a little younger than Florida because they were trying to compete quicker. But you're looking for change of scenery guys. You're looking for pedigree guys that just haven't been working out or want to leave where they are, and trying to throw assets or similar guys back to get a deal done. They should be having a lot more movement than I think fans want them to have on their roster, because they should be looking into everything to get better. And at this point in the rebuild, they should be – every position's open. They don't have a number one center, but every position's open. Center's a priority. Every position but goalie's basically a priority, and you're still probably drafting goalies. We talked about maybe needing to sign a vet goalie, so there's still some goalie movement you expect. So, like, that's where they are. You don't want to get pigeonholed. I think some rebuilds get pigeonholed by, hey, we have our 1C, we have this, we need to find this other thing, and then they keep messing up finding that scoring winger. They keep messing up finding the complementary pieces and stuff. I think Philadelphia should just keep adding talent and trading anybody that allows them more things to get talent, if it's not talent directly.
So that's a good talk about the Flyers. We're certainly interested to see what they do this offseason. And now, as we wrap the show up, but this discussion could be 40 minutes. I have no idea. We must now talk about the Salt Lake City whoever's. They're not going to play home games on Sundays. How about that?
Here's what I'll say. Outside of some of the uniqueness of Utah as a state with their alcohol laws, the religiosity, and some of that stuff, Salt Lake is a good place for a hockey team. It was a good place for an Olympics. Canada and U.S. had a great Olympic show down there. I think
people don't appreciate that it's a really good sports market, because they don't you don't think about the Utah Jazz that much, which I understand. You don't think about Utah and BYU, but they have a ridiculously fierce rivalry, if you don't know about that.
Yeah, and here's the thing. The NHL has blatantly said, we are going to 36 teams because expansion and relocation fees are the only way we can substantially increase hockey-related revenue in a way to back up our commitments of rising the salary cap while making up for pandemic losses, while getting enough money to invest in the league to keep it growing through these deals, and make back some of the money that they've been losing with Arizona. So It makes like the talent level is high enough where they could probably support 34 teams. 36 teams, I don't know. That's a lot. However, they want a more skilled game and they want more scoring, so diluting the product a little to get it is great. Hey, McDavid's 100-point season isn't that great if Kucherov gets 100 points tonight,
100 assists,
FYI.
yeah, 100
Yeah,
assists and 70
100
goals.
assists, yeah.
Can I make one
But like,
point about that just for a second? Because I have my
yeah.
thoughts on what you're saying. But, like, when I think about this regular season, when you think about the lunacy of the playoff race at the end in the East is part of it. But, like, we could have two guys with 100 assists when only three other guys have had that before. We could have our first 70-goal scorer since the early 90s. And a lot of that in the early days of the 90s, the early times of Bettman, was because they were expanding and the product wasn't very good. And then we know what happened after that. Like, there's a lot of issues with, say, officiating. There's a lot of issues with the way the league is run, the people that are
Right.
involved in the league. We could go on to that forever. We've talked about that in previous podcasts. But the product on ice, in many ways, is as good as it's ever been. And
Yes and no.
I mean, I know you'll disagree with me
I
on some
mean,
of that,
it's a
but
larger conversation, but I mean, if you ex and I just want to get to the point of this conversation can only be had because it's a limit. It's a very large topic of how would you run a professional hockey league?
how would you run a
You
professional
know, it
sports league?
covers so many things of growing the game versus prioritizing fans versus players and owners and all. There's so many hands and mouths to feed. But like just talking about Arizona and Salt Lake, you have to accept realities. And some of the realities are 36 teams is happening. It's happening whether we like it or not. And if that's the case, Salt Lake City is a great choice because you look at all the possibilities, Salt Lake City is in the top four, and that's how many cities they need. That's how I look at it.
Which I don't think is a bad way to look at it, and I'll get to your expansion point in a second.
But I think they need to do, and where I throw some more opinions into this reality, and some of the reality is like they gave the owner of the Coyotes, who didn't deserve it, too much money and the ability to buy back in. They shouldn't have done it, but they needed to do it because they need the TV market in Arizona. And the only reason the Arizona expansion hasn't worked is because of the local politics, which are garbage. And we won't get into that, but also because the NHL won't pick good owners. And if they can't detach themselves from the worst of the Arizona owners, which is saying something for sure, there's going to be a problem. It came out that they had to basically, other hotels and the league and teams had to force them to pay delinquent hotel bills.
According to Frank Saravalli, that he said on one of his podcasts, yes.
Yes.
Now, can I make one point by briefly interrupt you here? Forgive me. Forgive me for this. We all remember the Katie Strang story in The Athletic of all of the shenanigans with the Arizona Coyotes. I am fairly confident, and this is a guess, it's not me saying I know something's coming. This isn't like with the Kim Mulkey story a while back, if you followed that. I'm fairly confident more of that will be reported. Like, we're going to get
Yeah.
stories of things the Coyotes did that either it has not been substantiated yet, they're waiting for the move to happen, whatever, that are going to make people go, "Are you serious? You did what?" And now, here's my point on Morello that I want to follow up with you on. Like, the Coyotes have had a lot of bad owners, including the league, let's remember. The league owned the
Yes.
team at one point. The problem that I have with the way the league did this is, and here's my overall takeaway with Gary Bettman here, who I want to focus on. This is not Gary Bettman's biggest failure. It's not possible for it to be his biggest failure as commissioner when you lost a season due to a lockout. There were two others, the CTE denial, the Blackhawk scandal is a disgrace to the league, all of that. And there are many other areas that I'm probably forgetting. But when it comes to owners, and when it comes to finding owners to work in this league, in the last decade or so, Gary Bettman's actually been pretty good at it because we can go through all of the stories all of the markets where, to put it in his words, he put out fires for good. Like, when you think about whatever you want about on the on-ice product, you have the Islanders situation is solved. They figured out a way to defuse the Senators grenade. We saw them transition ownership in Florida, basket case franchise to what it is now. Tampa, we talk about getting in Bill Foley, we talk about getting in Seattle. They're going to have an arena in Calgary, all of this. But Gary Bettman's biggest failure here with the Coyotes is he did not see the forest through the trees with Alex Morello, because when he bought the team, Gary Bettman's number one priority is not just keep hockey in Arizona, but, oh, here's a Latino owner. That's a big deal for this sport in this state. And apparently, I have to look into it, and I should have looked into it earlier, and I need to, and maybe I will. But, like, apparently when he was looking into the NBA, the NBA told him to get lost. And I need to look at more details of that story, yeah. Because, you know, we know what Gary Bettman in the NBA is. And because of Morello's ownership, again, I apologize for interrupting you, but let me finish this one point. If Morello doesn't do the stuff he does with Glendale, and not paying, and giving Glendale the runaround, which kept the Coyotes over all sorts of things telling them not to for years, and then Glendale told them to get lost, the Coyotes are not moving if Morello doesn't do that stupid stuff to Glendale. Because the Coyotes could have been in Glendale, bad arena, bad location, we all get that, in perpetuity, because at least it's an NHL arena. Mullet's not. I know that Mullet's closer to where their fans live, but Glendale's a normal NHL arena. They could have been there forever, and we're not talking about Salt Lake City. I mean, maybe we would have talked about Salt Lake City if this arena thing kept getting kicked the can down the road, but it wouldn't have been an immediate live grenade they have to defuse by moving the team. And the other part of this that people have mentioned, and I think this is really key, and I don't know exactly the internal workings of NHL labor stuff, but when they changed to Marty Walsh, Marty Walsh is a different kind of labor leader than Don Fehr was. Don Fehr, I think, again, it's I think I feel I know, quoting my friends at Split Zone Duo, I think that Don Fehr was very much a guy who used the hammer behind the scenes. He didn't want to do it publicly in the same way that Marty Walsh did, because we remember that press conference at the All-Star game where he tore into everyone about the Coyotes, and he said, I'm not tolerating this anymore. The players are clearly not happy, but it took their leader going on blast in public saying, we're not doing this anymore. And maybe that was Gary Bettman's misreading of the room that now is leading to the Coyotes moving, because Don Fehr probably doesn't do the same things that Marty Walsh does that leads to Gary Bettman going to Morello and saying, are you sure you've got something lined up concretely, 100% guaranteed, there will be shovels in the ground? And Morello's like, I don't know. And then that brings in the doubt, and that leads to the ball rolling down the hill.
Yes, but Bettman choosing this owner is 100% one of the reasons why he shouldn't be a commissioner anymore. I don't know why he picked him, but for whatever reason he picked him, it's a bad reason, because he was a very clear from the outside the wrong ownership pick. And you correctly pointed out that this is all because he fucked around and found out with Glendale, and then he continued to fuck around and find out with all of the NHL vendors. And at a certain point, when the NHLPA and other owners are complaining to Bettman, he has to listen. It doesn't matter if it's his own son or daughter. He has to, you know, pull the plug at the end of the day, because those are his constituents. That's why he gets paid the big bucks, and that's why he is who he is. So I totally get why it happened. I think that Bettman, though, the reason it happened the way it did and everything is because it's hard to really work around your own mistake without admitting it and without basically doing the mea culpa, like, I should have never brought this guy in. I've made a public black eye even worse.
And for this years is what made it more surprising to me, because of his owners that he has gotten into the league,
Yeah.
Most of them have been pretty good from the ownership perspective. I understand that most of you are going to say owners aren't great in general.
Outside of Arizona, yep. He can't do it in Arizona. And so to leave the door for Arizona and say, I'm going to go back there with this guy who I'm going to have to replace down the line anyway, or I'm going to have to pick a new owner for Arizona because this guy won't have the money. But it's clear that they want Arizona to be in that last round again, that they're giving Arizona time for their city politics to figure it out and for an owner to materialize and to figure it out and come back stronger, because they've put on paper why they need the TV market. That's going to be a growing area. And we know they prioritize certain markets, and that's one of the markets they prioritize for tax reasons, for TV market reasons, for
Austin Matthews reasons,
for where population is growing and where they think that they can sell merchandise with and everything.
Can I go back to your expansion point for a second, because I want to drill down on this for a second. I do also think we're heading to 36, and the reason why I think we're heading to 36, and I think that they're going to be back, I think in some cases sooner than people think in Arizona. I also want to have a comment on Salt Lake City and Ryan Smith in a second. But here are some things that people should keep their eyes out for. And again, this is not me reporting. This is just me looking at tea leaves. The next two big items for Gary Bettman to deal with are a Canadian TV deal that's up in 2026, which no matter what the rumors are, it's going to get a lot of money because it's the Canadian TV deal for the NHL. It's a big deal. And then the CBA. The CBA is going to definitely have provisions in it for expansion. We all know that. But it's not these two dates that are interesting to me. The two dates that are interesting to me are actually 2028, when the US TV deal is done. And follow me here for a second. We understand that the media market in the United States is gigantic. We understand that the Arizona media market, Phoenix, is huge. But when I look at how sports media rights money is going and the trends that I see, you're not going to get automatic giant increases anymore just because you are a sport on television, whether streamers get involved or not, because that moment might have passed. You're still going to probably get increases, but you might not get the same level of increases. And so what's an easy way for you, the National Hockey League, that is in 23 U.S. markets, if you consider that L.A. has two teams and the New York area has three, and you have your seven Canadian teams, what's the easiest way for you as the NHL to get more money into hockey-related revenue from your U.S. television deal from whoever your partners are? It is more U.S.-based teams. And it's not just the billion-dollar expansion fees. It's the fact that you are now in Phoenix again. You are in Atlanta again. You might be in Houston. And to me, that is the trick that I think they're going to pull to get more revenue into the pot, because it is an easy way to do it when you have untapped growth potential in U.S. markets, which is what the NHL has that other leagues, the NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NFL, don't have in the same way. And my other thought is, because of that, I think an expansion team, if the Coyotes and Morello, and you don't trust them necessarily, can get something sorted out, or the Atlanta group gets something sorted out, whichever one wins, I think you could see expansion by the first or second year of the new TV deal, because the partners aren't going to pay for teams that don't exist and might not exist, but they will pay for teams that they know are going to exist. And to me, I think that becomes a date to watch when it comes to expansion. Personally, I think Arizona and Atlanta come first because they've already been there and the process is a little further down the pike. Then I think you're talking about Houston, and then I think, because you really do need to throw a bone to some of those our friends in Canada, I think that 36th team is Quebec City, or possibly that off-rumored, never actually serious second team in Toronto if you can't make Quebec City and its quirks work. This is my guess.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm going right into that. I think what happens is before 2030, expansion happens for sure. I think the teams are Atlanta and Houston. I don't think Arizona gets in until the second round. I then think that they will have then Arizona, and they will be able to think, you know, find of another city.
Which I said, a Canadian city.
I think it's an American city. And I'll tell you why. I think for the Canadian city, they move Winnipeg. And they move Winnipeg to Quebec, or you move Winnipeg to Hamilton / Toronto number two. Because at the end of the day, the Canadian market and the Canadian economy is not going to be healthy enough to handle that, to handle another team, unless, you know, maybe in Quebec, because they're so, you'll get that Francophone fever, and you'll get some help there. But, you know, Toronto obviously would be the best way to counteract any economy is to put one in Hamilton or Toronto.
And what that would mean in some likelihood is, because of the whole stuff with MLSE and Rogers and Bell, again, it gets into a lot of politics, but like what would end up happening there is Rogers would be in bed with one of the teams and Bell would be in bed with the other,
which is
probably
which is why,
in that scenario in game theory.
Yeah, which is why you think why I say it'd be relocation, because can't because they would want they wouldn't want to saturate the market with another Canadian team without taking, you know, something away. And I also think Quebec City's hurt because Bell and Rogers is less likely to okay another Canadian team if it's closer to them. Same with Montreal. Why would Montreal allow a Quebec team to come in and take some of their revenue pie? Because there's going to be a lot of people who will not be Montreal Canadian fans anymore.
I mean, there is an interesting debate to have about Quebec City and can they do the corporate? Is it good for the league to be in a market that is primarily non-English? There are all these.
It might be the same, but it would be better than Winnipeg. It would be better than Winnipeg, and you would be able to get the cash on hand to pay the relocation fee. And like I said, Toronto and Quebec City are probably one of the only cities where you could get an ownership group willing to pay an expansion fee to relocate a team. So you could get to 36 teams. You could get to 36 teams, hit Atlanta, Houston, come back to Arizona, and still have another location that you could go to inside the U.S. to get to 36, while increasing and making Canadians happy by taking Winnipeg, one of the weaker franchises, and moving it to Quebec City, where it would at least be a medium health franchise, or put it in Toronto, where it would be healthy. I mean, if the Mets can generate revenue after all these years in New York City, a losing team in Toronto.
I think a lot of people, I mean, well, the one thing we should say is that, like, there are 15 million people that live in Ontario, and the population of Canada is like 40 million. Who knows what that's going to look like when we eventually get to this point. So, like, there is something untapped in that area around the GTA, perhaps. But I also want to make one other point on Winnipeg, because you always heard about the relocation stuff, like, relocating them in Canada would at least be tolerable. Like, I've always maintained that I don't think they're going to relocate the Jets because they don't want to relocate another Canadian team to an American city. They don't want to do that again. Now, do I think that that is more likely that they would relocate Winnipeg to either, you know, second team in GTA or Quebec than, you know, relocating them to an American city? Yeah, but I think they're going to try to make Winnipeg work. The other part of this that I want to mention, as we start to wrap this up, because this podcast has gone on forever, but told you it would, is for Gary Bettman, what do we think his end game is? Because whatever you think about whether he's good or not, and obviously most people do not think he's good, I think he's got some pluses that people don't want to acknowledge, but he's also got huge problems. No doubt about that. To me, I'm also thinking about his endgame, because he's 72 this June. Yeah. When the Canadian TV deal and the CBA are done, he's 74. We are seeing retirements now of announcers who, you know, Jeff Rimmer's 73. Congratulations on a great career. Jack Edwards is younger, but, like, can I say that I think for Gary Bettman, like, what is his end game? Like, is his end game, I'm going to give you a new CBA, I'm going to give you a new Canadian TV deal, I'm going to set the stage for expansion that Bill Daly will then fill in, and I'm going to ride off into the sunset? Now, I brought this theory up to Jeff Merrick, our friend, recently, and he's like, I don't know if Gary Bettman wants to retire. And I'm like, I clearly see that. He's 72 and he's still going. But my point is, because some of us thought that expansion to Seattle and Vegas and getting through the pandemic was going to be his going away present to the owners, et cetera, et cetera. And then I leave the reins to Bill Daly. But now he's still
Bill
here.
Bill Daly's like 70.
I don't know how old he is, actually. I got to look that up. But my other point is, when you think about these two major items that are going to be dealt with, and it's very clear to me that he's going to deal with them before we even get to retirement, right? Like, we're getting the CBA and you're going to get the Canadian TV deal done by Bettman before anything else happens. So, like, is that his end game? Because he still gave the owners, with the flipping of the Coyotes and selling it to Ryan Smith, a little extra money, like either $200 or $300 million that is split into the pot, however it works. So is that his, you know, his going away present? I'm going to set the stage for at least two more teams and two more $1 billion expansion fees.
Nope. I think he's thinking he's going through till 2030. I think his end game is, I'm going to give new Canadian deal, TV deal, new American TV deal, 36 teams, and I'm going to, you know, do that. And I think part of the reason he wants to keep going is because he's built a team of people who are not fit to take his job. Bill Daly is a very good deputy commissioner. I'm not sure. I mean, I think Bill Daly out of every, would be a you know, better than Bettman, but I don't necessarily know if it's, you know, he's 60. I just looked up.
So he's 59. He's going to be 60. Yes.
Yeah. So he's Zito's age, which is, I can't see it. But you know, I could, but like by that time he'd be close to 70. I don't know. Maybe he's a little bit of the stepping stone, but I think he's been so reluctant to hand it off because, you know, after a while, it's like, you know, there's no real heir apparent with energy, with a lot of ideas and zest. That's really like,
I mean, like, you could almost kind of see it as a Roger Goodell kind of, because he's still going, even though some of the, like, because you also have the NBA had the designated heir in Adam Silver, and there are questions about that, but it is something that you're thinking about when it comes to all these big ticket items, because, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, and also with the Canadian TV deal being at the same time as the CBA, highly unlikely we see a lockout at that point. Now, it's Gary Bettman, so it could happen, obviously, but
yeah. One final point. I think he does 36 teams and all of that, and whether it's the 36 teams being in the league with players on ice, or if it's 36 teams with the locations and owners, you know, giving a deposit, I don't know. But I think he does. I think since he's been very public about 36 recently and all that, like you're hearing a lot about that. He's really thinking big term, where he's going to be here a while, or he has a big end game, you know.
I mean, look, if you're getting $4 billion plus expansion fees, that's a lot of money to your owners.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and you know, this is basically him saying, like, we will be set up, and then it's about us, you know, it's about making sure that we garden and we keep things things right so we don't have to contract, we don't have to move franchises, whatever.
We have stable, because once you get to 32 with really no fires to put out anymore, this is the kind of stuff you think about.
Does any pro league even have 34 teams?
Nope.
So they'd be the first 34. They'd be the first 36, you'd have to guess.
Yeah.
They'd be the first to Vegas. Because when you think
about the NBA, they're going to expand, but that'll get them to 32. Baseball, if they expand, that'll get them to 32. The NFL, I don't think, is in a true position to expand in the way that, like, they're going to talk about international, but they're lying. So the NHL getting up to 36, like, they were the first team to Vegas, and they really succeeded because they were the first real team in Vegas. They got back to Seattle before the NBA did. That was a big deal. And so that's something Gary Bettman can say and uses his legacy. Ah, we were the first to get to X, Y, and Z when it comes to, you know, his own legacy.
I think he will also So when you have 36 teams, you're going to have to get real creative about how all these teams can get special events. All of these teams.
Oh, you're going to have to talk about playoff expansion. You're going to have to do a lot of different things.
I think playoff expansion is easy. You know, if there's 36 teams, there's 18 teams and that make the playoffs, and maybe there's play-in rounds to get to those 18. And, you know, you figure it out. I mean, I know Ray Ferraro can't say nice things about the Panthers when he's on a broadcast, but he does have some decent ideas about the play-in. You can find on Twitter if you want to kind of know more of my thoughts. Something like that would be fine with me. But I think what Bettman could do, or what Daly could pick up and do, and I think that they've kind of been working towards this, I think eventually they want to work out a way, a repeatable event in Europe against European teams and against other NHL teams, whether it's a Champions Hockey League, like the teams that maybe don't make the playoffs but are at, you know, in the middle, go to the Champions League, or go to some sort of event over in Europe, the short tournament that drives revenue and stuff like that, that could, you know, be fun. And, you know, teams can say that they've won, they can have special jerseys. You'd be having, you know, fans travel to Europe. You'll have European fans spending money to see NHL players in person. You know, something like that, I think, would be the only other addition that I think, it, you know, is realistic to see Bettman kind of be alive for or have his fingerprints on. But I think that's something that they've been going to. And I think one of the reasons they haven't been in fully to the World Cup of Hockey and all that stuff is because they were trying to get something like that up and running, or trying to look into that as a replacement. I think they want to do more than just have 6 to 8 games in Europe in the fall. I think they definitely want to do more than that, and they want to go to Asia. I think they're going to want to start going to Asia and stuff like that. China, obviously, Japan, some of these other countries. I think they're going to want to, Australia, they're going to want to have a presence in for sure.
Okay, so let me just make one more point about this, because this is a really long podcast and we want you to be able to listen to it before the playoffs, but I guess you can listen to it in sections. And there's another show coming. Getting Ryan Smith into the league is a good thing. Like, he's going to be, I think, a good owner. He's going to spend money. The arena situation will get sorted in Utah. And I think that with the minor hockey history in that market, like, I understand the NHL, like, really wanting this guy to be in. And this is why the Morello stuff is even more frustrating, because the NHL now has to deal with Morello to avoid lawsuits because they let him into the club, and now it's really hard to kick them out. They really want him in. I think it's good that they want him in. I think he's going to be a smart owner. I think he's going to spend money, and that's going to be good for all of the players in free agency this year. That's going to increase hockey-related revenue. That's a, you know, now that you don't have Arizona spending most of their cap on dead contracts. I think that is a good thing for the league to be in a market that, again, you have untapped potential there, because the only other big team, big four league, is the NBA, although they have two good soccer teams there in the Utah Royals and Real Salt Lake. So these are good things, and I think that the NHL is going to look fairly smart by getting into this market as it's cresting upward. And the owner is exactly the guy you would want in that market. He's committed to making it work. He's committed to Salt Lake City, and that's a good thing. Now, it shouldn't have taken the Coyotes being this kind of disaster to get there, but they do have a soft landing, and it is going to be, I think, a success, even if the Delta Center is not a hockey arena. I understand that, but like, when you know there's something else coming and you know the guy in charge is going to be able to pull those strings, it's going to be all right.
Yeah, you know that it's, when it gets built, it's going to be probably in the nicer half of NHL arenas. Like, you know he's not going to be like, all right, the locker room area is going to feel like an away locker room. Where with Arizona, even if they got a place in Glendale and stuff with their owner and everything, I didn't really have faith that it would be, you know, a top end facility, or a facility that would remain top end. Like, it would quickly deteriorate, because maintenance and upkeep costs are some of the things that owners frequently cut out budgets when they need to save money. So, like, that won't be the case in Utah. And I completely agree, you know, Salt Lake with this owner, that was the perfect landing spot. I wish it happened 2 to 3 years earlier. But the problem was, you know, that you can't have too many changes, and they really wanted to get Seattle and Vegas in. And you can understand why. And, you know, luckily Smith was willing to hang out and wait and buy his time. And, you know, I think that team's going to be good. I'm interested in the name. I'm interested in the jersey concept. But if you're thinking about it, it's a winter sport town. Not that, you know, summer sport towns aren't cool too, for the NHL, but I like having a good balance. I think the diversity of all things is good. So having, you know, this is going to be a, you know, there's some tech, there's some, microbreweries, there's, you know, skiing, there's, a lot of money and investment and, you know, things that, you know, you see with growing cities and stuff like that. Obviously it's already a big city. It's, you know, it's not like Salt Lake City.
And as we end this show, because it's gone on for 2 hours and 15 minutes according to my recording, it's probably not going to be that at all said and done. Looks like if you stayed till the end, because you are really weird and really unique, to bring it back to the start, it's been a pleasure to do this ridiculously long show, maybe the longest in Y hockey history. There are more to come, of course, but until then, good night and good hockey.